so I'm gradually getting to the routine here. Screen seems to work today. Could go a little bit lower, but you know, we're in pretty good shape. Unfortunately, our numbers are not such that we can justify changing rooms, but I'll still try to request a room above ground. Yeah, it's just a little weird down here. I mean, once we're all packed in here, we can forget that we're down two floors underground. It's a little weird. Yeah, maybe we can argue that we would fit into a smaller room that somebody else will be vacating. So, except for a laser pointer, which I will try to pick up, I'm ready to go. And as promised, I am going to review what we talked about last week. If I can get my screen to... That doesn't help. Light up so I can see it. So I'm going to repeat several times that we're not ruled by guns. We're ruled by ideas. Ideas that bind us, for better and for worse. I mean, we have to be bound in the sense that we have to have a system in which we work together in. But those ideas may not be the ideas that are appropriate given the world that we now know we live in. And yet there's this incredible lag time and sort of how we think and how we've organized ourselves around earlier thinking and then getting out of the mess that we're in. So that's critically important. The next point that I wanted to make was that this transition from a hunter and gatherer society to an agricultural society is the beginnings of a lot of change, and it happens from 15,000 to 500 years ago, though it's still in process. There are still societies that are hunter and gatherer switching to ag or right into industrial societies. But the human population went from more or less 5 million people to 500 million people with the invention of agriculture. Admittedly, this happened over a 15,000 year period, so it happened fairly slowly. And there are agricultural societies that crashed because they overshot their bounds, they messed up in one way or the other. But still, by a simple process of learning by doing, a whole lot of change and transformation of nature took place. And we tend to overly stress or overly worship modern science. And that's why I stress human learning through simple learning by doing, which unfortunately is still extremely important. You know, we think of science as originating in the laboratory. Most of the medicines we use are trial and error, not designed. When we designed Viagra, it was for heart medicine. Okay? And that's not how it turned out to best be used. So, you know, trial and error is extremely important today. But unfortunately, we really don't have time for a lot of trial and error. And so that means the precautionary principle is extremely important. I want to repeat that for most of human history, most of written history, thinking about economics has been thinking about fairness, not about efficiency. And we had that little discussion. When does efficiency even begin to show up in what we recognize as economics? And it's really not until about 140 years ago. It's a very recent idea. And yet today, that idea kind of rules our beliefs in economics. That this is, you know, economics tells us about efficiency. And we'll debunk a fair amount of that, but mostly we'll be debunking that there's some sort of a trade-off between fairness and efficiency. That's a popular belief that economists perpetrate that is not within economic thinking itself. I want to just reiterate that while we think of mercantilism as a period of history and some sort of a school of thought, it was never a school of thought. It was just a way in which we were organized, but not a way that was systematically thought through. But it was a way of the state sanctioning individuals, corporations, this is the beginning of corporations, and then corporations both had responsibilities and rights. And it's the responsibility side that tends to get forgotten, but they were very true. And so East India Company really was the face of Britain in India. And it was responsible for behaving more or less, you know, correctly as it was thought to be correct at the times. And the local pub or the local hotel was expected to provide certain services and had responsibilities in the community, while it had the right to provide those services and keep other people out. And so it was very much a systemic view of how do you run a system, not just a system somehow runs itself. You guys didn't correct my chemistry. Okay, I was talking about mass balance, and you guys were just awfully courteous. I had half as many hydrogen as I needed. And did you guys notice it? Somebody? I mean, you can. Okay. I mean, I'm correctable, guys. You can pounce on me. It's okay. I make my notes too fast, and didn't balance my equation. But that was the idea, was that economics doesn't bother balancing its equations. And so I was unfortunately illustrating the problem. But yes, economics starts out in the physical sciences saying we really ought to understand it as a physical system. And then soon after, it has another start in the moral sciences. Well, it's always kind of been in that fairness, moral sciences realm, but Adam Smith comes along. But this question, is it in the moral sciences or is it in the physical sciences, wasn't all that clear, really, until well into the 20th century. And even then, it's been contested. And ecological economics itself says, you've got to be able to make all those bridges. You can't. The barriers that economics sets up to say economists really don't have to understand how to balance their chemical equations and economists really don't have to read moral philosophy. We just have to read economics. That's the problem. And that's sort of symptomatic of society today. We talked about Adam Smith starting out with the theory of moral sentiments. The idea that, and I'll just go back, the idea that we are naturally good because we feel each other's pain. But it's a lot easier to feel each other's pain within a family, though that sometimes gets messed up. It's a lot easier to feel each other's pain with close neighbors and in a small community with the people that you're interacting with regularly as you pick up your bread in the morning or have your shoes fixed once every 6 months, as opposed to living in a globalized economy. It's very difficult, though modern communications help, but feeling the pain of those who make our shoes in China today is, a little bit of an abstract idea compared to feeling each other's pain 200 years ago living in smaller communities. And that basic premise is still built into sociology today, that the idea of distance affects our social relations, and distance both being a physical distance, but also cultural distances, disciplinary distances, get in our way of being communities. And as the problems of corruption keep showing up, economists begin to think that, moral societies and having trust in each other, these things sort of outside the boundaries of economics are actually important after all. That to have an efficient economy, you have to have a lot of trust, you have to have a lot of honesty, and that comes with having strong social communities, not just having competitive firms working in the abstract. So a lot of Adam Smith is alive and well today. We had the little exchange where I described Adam Smith in terms of the take-home points that we take home today, and David got upset and said, but I didn't really describe Adam Smith. And that was true. I said, Adam Smith wrote a very fat book. We passed it around, and then we talked about what could be said in 6 or 7 pages. Though it does show up periodically through the book, he's constantly balancing this idea of markets and the role of the state. Economics has for a long time been about the role of markets and the role of the state and how they interact or compete or both. And The Wealth of Nations is very much in that mode. But we also take things away and condense stuff down and create simple messages, because it's really hard to communicate big fat books. And so it's kind of necessary in a society to say, Adam Smith said this in 12 words. But when we do that, we lose all the context, all the richness, all the ifs, thens, and buts that are incredibly important. But we have a belief in simplicity. Sort of the Western mind has a passion that things ought to be able to be reduced to fairly simple ideas, to sort of a few equations, and everything ought to be explainable with that. And we'll be dealing with that today. So we're going to look at what Robert Heilbronner called the worldly philosophers for a period of the beginning of the 19th century. And Heilbronner called them the worldly philosophers. He was an economist with the New School for Social Research in New York City, a very broad philosopher himself who sort of looked at economics as a very worldly philosophy sort of phenomena, as we will be doing in this course. And the people we'll talk about also continue to affect us today. In the case of August Comte, they actually affect how we're organized today. So Malthus is probably one of the most important voices of his age. And he's trained in mathematics, but then he goes into the clergy. He becomes a preacher. And as a preacher, he's interested in the big worldly problems of why do we have crime? Why do we have war? Why is life on earth so unheaven-like? And he searches for a secular answer to that, kind of a scientific explanation. And he comes up with a very simple answer that becomes incredibly compelling. But he's arguing in defiance of this sense of progress that's all around, that we're beginning to see improvements in agriculture. Boats are definitely getting better. We're able to get around the world much better than before. Unfortunately, guns are getting better. A few other things. So there's a great sense of progress, as we talked about with Condorcet and later Godwin. But Adam Smith comes up with two curves. One increases arithmetically or linearly, and that's food production. Food production over time can increase. And he argues it can increase because we see it increasing. It's an empirical phenomenon. So he's not just a theorist, he's an empiricist. He says the data obviously support that food production increases, and it increases because we farm new lands, we clear the forest, we push out further. He doesn't say maybe that's limited. But he also acknowledges what we would just call technology today, that we are getting better crops from the New World, from other continents, and those crops come to Europe without pests, and they grow better, and productivity is increasing. So he has progress, but progress is kind of linear. Okay? You say, well, why is it linear? Well, he just says it is. The other curve is population. Two people can easily have 4 children. 4 children can easily have, 16, on and on. It goes up geometrically. It's exponential. Population, people can breed like rabbits. And furthermore, they do. Okay? If there's enough food. And, you know, he kind of looks for empirical evidence of this, where in good times, population increases. And the data on population are very bad. But he's still trying to be the empiricist. He's doing his best to actually get population figures by particular counties, by particular districts. You know, somebody has collected population data over 80 or 100 years, and he shows it going up geometrically. And then he says, look, population's going to outstrip food supply, and then there's going to be trouble. And this explains why people keep having trouble, why we have violence, why we have robbery, why we end up going to war because of shortages. And this idea that shortage drives bad human activity is prevalent today. You know, we would have peace if there was just plenty. We've got more plenty than we've ever had before. We still don't have peace. But still, the idea that we will be peaceful peoples if there's just enough stuff. We'll all relax, sit in our rocking chairs and read our Bibles and become more moral, and, you know, abusive women will go away. Everything will be fine. Well, okay, it's kind of a simple story. But think about it. Two curves. Two simple curves. And you get the explanation of human history. You get the explanation of moral behavior and immoral behavior. You get an explanation of what we need to do, and there it's very simple. People need to be abstinent until they marry, and they should marry late in life. Straightforward. And so you get rules for life out of two curves. One linear, the other geometrical or exponential. Okay? Straightforward. I guess I've said all of that, so I'll just briefly let you look at it. Those two curves are incredibly famous. Marxists hate them because it puts all the blame on people, and in particular poor people, uncultivated people. It's those uncultivated people that need this religion. The cultivated people are already fairly moral and going to church out of habit. And, you know, maybe they don't go to church every week, but they behave well. But it's those poor people that are badly behaved and breed like rabbits and will continue to breed and live at the level of subsistence. And even while Marxists hate this idea because it blames all of the human problems on the poor instead of on the rich, they still build on it. So this idea of a living, you know, subsistence wage becomes central to the labor theory of value and the whole idea that human progress is breaking out of this condition that's very much built into Karl Marx's theory of history that is still with us. That, you know, the reason we've pushed development for the last 70 years, 65 years, is to break people out of this human condition and get them on the road to progress. So even while it's hated, it's very much appreciated. It's very much in use. It's part of how we think today. It was also the basis of a very famous book in my time while I was just entered the University of Chicago, called The Population Bomb, written by Paul Ehrlich. Paul was still a professor at Stanford University, you know, officially retired but still spouting off. Very important biologist, because he also was the sort of co-inventor or reinventor of the idea of co-evolution in evolutionary theory, writing a famous paper in 1963. So I learned a lot from Paul and, you know, have known him for most of my life and had the good, you know, the advantage of knowing him for most of my life. But he wrote a book in the late 60s called The Population Bomb, showing that there were incredible increases of population following World War II, with the development efforts following World War II, with bringing modern medicine to the third world. And this couldn't possibly go on. And by 1980, 1990, we'd be in deep trouble. And of course, we are still kind of struggling along, doing pretty well. And so Paul Ehrlich must be wrong, Malthus must be wrong. And yet, to this day, we have Malthusian arguments because it is so basically understandable. Okay? And so we have professors today on this campus who, you know, basically say Malthus is right, or will be soon, or was always right, but because we listened to Malthus, we kept solving problems before they got really bad. But underlying, Malthus is right. Okay? And maybe he is. Maybe he was. Okay? Or maybe we just need simple models like this to communicate, to understand the situation we're in at large enough levels across enough different disciplines to sort of bong us on the head with, oh, let's think of it this way. At a very basic, simple level, aren't we in deep trouble? Okay? And so models, even while they're way too simple, are still very important. Okay? And that's part of the message, because that's a lot of what's going on in economics is very much the same thing. Tanya.
The Malthusian argument is a simple model, but it's not really originally his, is it? It's a very basic ecological model that populations grow beyond the environmental limit and then they crash.
It's really attributable to Malthus. There really isn't someone that we can identify before him that said that. And we can go back in history and see sort of the chronicling of crashes that people in earlier times were aware that civilizations crashed, but they didn't sort of put it together. You know, it was just 10 years of drought and they crashed. And it wasn't because population outstripped food supply and this kind of, I mean, it was really the rise of mathematical thinking that...
Maybe we didn't realize this before because it happens with animals all the time.
I'm not saying it wasn't happening. I'm saying we didn't really codify it, or we don't have evidence of it having been codified before Malthus, which is, you know, very recent history. It's unbelievable. It's such a basic idea. It's so recent.
Yeah, we didn't come up with evolution until recently.
Okay, so that's the next point. Okay? That this very simple model is absolutely instrumental to both Alfred Wallace and Charles Darwin. Both of them, writing in the 1850s, 1860s, said they read Thomas Malthus. And they said, aha, a big light goes on. Populations grow exponentially and push up against their environmental limits. And this means natural populations are frequently or almost constantly under pressure. And if they're under pressure, then which individuals of a population survive? Ah, the individuals that are most fit. Okay? And so a basic concept of evolutionary or evolution by natural selection, because there were evolutionary theories before Darwin and Wallace. Okay, you'd like to ask a question?
Yeah, I was wondering, like, at the same time we talk about it being so recent, it seems very from like a Western lens, like at this same time or before these times, like when did sort of economic thinking hit like what we would consider now like the Eastern world, like China, India, like did they have ideas on markets and pricing mechanisms?
And that's a very good question. And I'm not enough of an expert to know. They certainly had theories of social organization and, you know, the Western interpretation of the hydraulic society is a way of thinking about Chinese organization going way back and the importance of paddy rice and the delivery of water and how that was sort of a controlling feature. But there was much less use of markets and much more, you know, community-level planning or authoritarian-level planning.
So is economics sort of like the result of Western thinking? So that sort of thinking would contribute
as much? But we can find markets that still go way back thousands of years, because we know there are people who traded spices. We know that salt was traded. We know that arrowheads were traded, or obsidian was traded. So this, you know, goes back 10, 20,000 years at least. And so it's not that people never organized themselves this way. It's that sort of the explanation that this is a logical way to organize ourselves, that we should organize ourselves in this way through markets, that arises in the 18th century and 19th century, and then really becomes codified by the end of the 19th century. So it's a co-evolution of the ideas of markets with the transformation of our social organization. But it goes way back. But where, you know, what its history might be in India or China or Indonesia, where clearly there were markets of some sort sometimes, but not so importantly. I mean, it was much more reciprocity. Trade that really wasn't trade in exchange, but exchange that was built into part of the culture. You do, you know, you help each other with the expectation that somebody else will help you, was more true of, or anthropologists say it is more true of other societies. But again, untangling that, because we see through the lenses that we see through. It's like, how do you describe economies before we had economic models to think about economies? And so that is even more of a problem as we cross cultures and try to go back in history. Yeah. Okay. So scientists do learn from each other. And the idea that evolution is really tied to our development and thinking about economic systems, or at least social systems, is recognized by ecologists and evolutionary theorists. But at the same time, as I applied co-evolutionary thinking to think about society and environment, biological scientists would say, you just can't take ideas from biology and apply them to the social systems. Yeah, you just can't do that. And I said, well, Darwin and Wallace did that. And, you know, we wouldn't be, you know, biology wouldn't be where it is if it weren't for that. So we do learn from each other. But increasingly, that's more and more and more difficult as we dig down deeper and deeper and deeper and become more and more specialized. So if you look at scholars, it was fairly easy for Darwin and Wallace to be reading Malthus. There were only several hundred books that really needed to be read at the time. Okay? And you say, well, that's not true. Okay, so maybe there were 400 books that needed to be read, but 50 of them that really should be read. And so it's just a lot easier to cross boundaries than it is today. And, you know, fortunately we have ways of formalizing our knowledge so it's more transferable, and there's all kinds of different ways things are helping us. But still, the idea that it's up to us to cross those boundaries and draw on each other is extremely important. And that's part of the idea of ecological economics, that ecological economics is really premised on this crossbreeding between ecological thinking and economic thinking. That's part of the obligation of being an ecological economist that environmental economists don't assume. Okay, so we're going to go to a second really simple model, though apparently the presentation of that simple model in chapter 2 of Ricardo is not that simple. But David Ricardo got rich early as a banker. Took 17 years to write The Principles of Political Economy, And this is actually the first use of the word political economy. The idea that it's about politics and about economics and political economy and very much about the role of the state. And Ricardo is famous for several things. The labor theory of value, though Malthus is beginning to form that labor theory of value, Ricardo takes it a couple of steps further. And even though Ricardo is, you know, the wealthy financier sect, Marx picks up on the labor theory of value, you know, coming from a very different perspective and using it in a very different way. But the other thing that Ricardo was really interested in, and does it very early on, I mean, chapter 2, is the theory of rent. And by rent, we're referring to the rent on land, the return to land. So while we apply the term rent usually to physical structures, buildings in particular, its basic meaning in economics is the return to land. And Ricardo's model, I know it didn't turn out to be that simple, but here's where I was supposed to have my laser pointer. Look at the bottom line, that staircase. This is a staircase of land quality. And over on the left, where it looks like the land quality is low, that's actually good, because it takes very little labor to work that land. And so you can get a bushel of wheat very easily on that land. And then as we use all of that land, so here's the story. We use the best land first. It'd be totally irrational not to use the best land first. So we use the best land first. But as population goes up, as wealth increases, as people begin to, you know, use some of the grain to feed cattle, we have to go to lower quality land. And by lower quality land, it means up the staircase, because it requires more labor to get a bushel of wheat off that land. And as that land comes into production, the first quality land earns a rent. Okay? Because the people who have high quality land get the same for their wheat as the people with low quality land. But they get to produce more wheat with the same amount of land or the same amount of labor. The labor input is lower, so they don't have to pay as many workers. And so the landlord walks away with a rent. Make sense? And that's that box. And then as you go up the staircase, the next box appears. And the second quality landowners begin to get rent. And the first quality landowners are now getting even a larger rent. Okay, so there's some puzzled faces out there. Go ahead.
So the rent is portrayed as the
box. That shaded box is in effect crop that doesn't have to pay laborers.
Well,
it's
only
a surplus.
That's only if you're at B.
It doesn't appear until you get to B.
Yeah.
And the B land doesn't get a rent until you're working the C land. And the C land doesn't get a rent until you're working the D land. Okay? So it's a straightforward explanation of rent. And Ricardo says, and naturally, whoever owns that best quality land deserves the rent somehow, for some reason deserves the rent. At least that's how they get it. That's where it comes from. It's a natural phenomena. He's famous for the little phrase, rent is that portion of the produce of the earth that is paid to the landlord, for the use of the original and indestructible powers of the soil. It's clear that economists didn't know nothing about land for a long time. OK? okay, that this problem of distancing and not really understanding that you can build up the quality of land or destroy the quality of land in 1817 when he wrote that book was not known by bankers. Okay, Dimitri, and then, is that a hand up too? Okay.
I just wanted some clarification.
Yeah.
So if rent is what is paid to the landowner by an external party,
yeah,
to use the indestructible powers of land, then who in the case where land use shifts to poor and poorer land,
yeah,
who is it that's paying this gray box? Because so it seems to me that you have different types of landowners who get kind of marginally lesser returns.
Yeah, so the price of wheat has to go up as you go to the lower and lower quality lands.
Right.
And that's, you know, ultimately
it's coming from everybody who's buying wheat.
Right. And then you have to ask the question, well, where does their money come from and how can they pay more? And then you get into the problems of microeconomics versus macroeconomics, which Ricardo doesn't get to. But yeah, that's maybe the piece of the story you missed. Yeah. Yeah.
So it seems like they were just at a lucky enough point in history to where like the ideas would be unquestioned and people would build off of that. Like not saying a question, because people were obviously like grilling these guys while they were writing these books, but like if the idea was new and you could like argue it on philosophical logics, and you must be right.
And that's to some extent true today. That, you know, logic holds, and simple logic is thought to be more valuable to scientific thinking than complex logic. That if you have a simple explanation that works, that's better than a complex explanation that maybe works a little bit better.
So is the peer review process just more or less different now?
No, we used to come to simple ideas still. We love simple ideas still. You know, the environmental Kuznets curve that we'll come to is a very nice simple idea that's bullshit. But we come, you know, we succumb to it all the time. So, yeah. It is very much with us today, and that's why I'm stressing this stuff now, is that we're looking for easy answers all the time. And, you know, I'm in correspondence now with the chair of the Delta Stewardship Council trying to determine the fate of the Delta, which is the fate of California water, and he wants, in the next 16 days, to convene a bunch of social scientists to give them answers to how to organize science for the Delta.
He just wants bullet points to figure it out in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, and that's the way the world works, is we need this stuff now. And the person that will deliver that simple answer now will rise to fame. Okay? And get paid in the process. And I'm in the position of having to say, well, it's not quite that easy, you know, kind of, because I chair the science board that's supposed to keep the process scientific. So it's very much in our lives today. But, okay, so this diagram, like Malthus's diagram, is very alive with us today. If you're a petroleum geologist, or if you're a, you know, just in the minerals industry generally, you hold to the idea that we go after the best oil first. And we've already gotten a lot of that oil. And then we have to go to the next quality of oil, and the next quality, and the next quality. And these are lower and lower qualities. It's harder and harder work to get the stuff. We're marching up Ricardo's staircase. And that describes mineral history, mineral extraction history. Okay. And, you know, coal used to be easily mined, and then we had to go underground to mine it, and now we have to blow mountaintops off to mine it. And it gets harder and harder and harder. And part of that hardness is our mineral resources are more linked to the environment that we're trying to separate it from. Okay? And so there's more and more and more environmental consequences as we go up the staircase. And that's surely true. Okay? So it's a very powerful model to think about the human dilemma today. But at the same time, it's not quite right. The first oil well in the United States is in Pennsylvania. Not a very good oil field. It takes another 50 years before we get to Texas oil. And our biggest oil field is in Prudhoe Bay. And 30 years ago when I was working in Brazil, we were told that the petroleum industry had been in Brazil looking for oil for 50 years and just hadn't found any. And now there's tremendous amounts of oil being discovered in Brazil. And so, you know, it's kind of true, but it's not true enough. And yet, when we think about the human dilemma, this picture is very much a pretty good way to describe it. So it's an extremely powerful model, but not quite right. So a recent PhD out of the Energy and Resources Group by Adam Brandt basically looked at going from, you know, high quality petroleum to lower quality petroleum to the tar sands of Alberta and all the controversy we're facing now with the pipeline or not, to get that oil across the United States so it can be exported to other countries, is very much this story. He tells it as this story, but not as so much in terms of increasing labor to work the land, but the increasing environmental costs because of the extra energy that has to be used, the energy cost of extracting energy. And then as you're using that energy, you are, in effect, ripping things apart and creating environmental problems. Okay? All in that diagram. 1817, David Ricardo. So, powerful ideas invented 200 years ago with very simple thinking. So models and simple patterns of thinking are extremely important. But they can get in our way too. And another one that's important that's around today, also looking at land use and why rents rise, is one by von Thunen, a German or Prussian, who basically argues that distance is important. Not for empathy, but overcoming transportation costs are important. And if you have to go to work in the city daily, we as people, overcoming distance, choose to live in the city itself. But we can have our dairy industry sort of in the next circle. And then further out, because we need forest for wood supply, we still need that fairly close. It's a little expensive to haul wood around. So that's in the next circle. Okay? And then next circle out is grains, grain production, because you only need to haul the grains in once a year. And then beyond that would be grazing. And sort of there's differential demands for land portrayed by these different willingness to pay, these demand curves, that give us a rent slope by type of use, by distance from the city center. And that's very much in use today in city planning thinking. And of course, transportation and new modes of transportation and building a BART line out through one of those circles and sort of opening up and making transportation cheap then has differential effects on land use. So again, 200 years ago, but a pattern of thinking that we very much use today. Okay, I'm down to my last slide, and so today might be a short lecture, except the next three people are pretty darn important. I just didn't develop enough slides. And Jeremy Bentham. basically codifies utilitarian theory and utilitarianism and the idea that individuals try to maximize their utility or maximize their happiness. So those of you, most of you who've had an economics course, have learned about utility curves and iso-utility curves and this idea that, you know, we have preferences that we are born with and that they're just there and we're all trying to maximize our happiness. This doesn't originate with Jeremy Bentham, but is codified and expanded upon by Bentham in a big way in the beginning of the 19th century. And he becomes the person we reference. He basically says the aim of society is to maximize the happiness for the greatest number. And of course, it's very hard to maximize two things simultaneously. But he honestly believed that we'd eventually be able to maximize, be able to measure utility, and maximize it for society as a whole. But out of Bentham, we get formalized the idea of diminishing marginal utility. That as you consume a good, the additional happiness from additional consumption goes down. So if you're consuming an apple, you say, boy, that was a really great apple. And you say, I think I'll have another one. Yeah, it might be pretty good. But it doesn't make you as happy as the first apple did. And then the third apple, you're kind of getting a little tired of apples. If you try to consume a fourth apple, you might actually be getting sick. And if it were ice cream cones, you would. Okay? And this is the idea of diminishing marginal utility. And this is the beginning of the use of calculus in economic thinking. That you actually can get functional relationships and begin to trade things off. And it's also the beginning of the idea that maybe rich people don't become as happy consuming another dollar worth of goods as poor people do. That there's a diminishing marginal utility of income. That as you get richer and richer and richer, you don't really get happier and happier and happier, the same as a poor person does when they become richer. And the diminishing marginal utility of income means you could probably tax the rich. You could justify taxing the rich proportionately more than taxing the poor. Very basic idea, which until 30 years ago was hardly questioned in our society at all. But it is now thought to be kind of unfair because the rich people are, okay, maybe they're not happier, but they're the job creators. They're what make the economy work. They're so good. We have all these rationalizations today about why we shouldn't tax the rich. But Bentham, started this. I mean, I don't think Christ was saying very similar things. So it's not like it's original with Bentham. A lot of religious voices early on are saying very similar things. But it becomes part of the secular philosophy. It becomes rationalized within sort of a non-religious context that Bentham is really important for. So, economics kind of just absorbs this. And there's a lot of stuff in Bentham that doesn't easily go into economics. And so economics is partly a mishmash, because economists know full well, you can't both maximize happiness and maximize it for the greatest numbers. You can't maximize two things simultaneously. And yet it's there. And it's very much there in our ideas of benefit-cost analysis or cost-benefit analysis. Bentham was basically saying society should be doing cost-benefit analyses on all these different things it's doing and looking at where is it really helping and where is it hurting and worrying about whether it's the rich or the poor that are being helped And we really ought to run society in this kind of rational, utilitarian sort of way. Which, it's not that it had never been thought of before, it's just never been put so consistently together with as much mathematics as Bentham used. The second person, Cournot, is also important. Cournot was a French philosopher who was a mathematician. And he gets taken by Adam Smith's ideas and tries to mathematize markets. And he begins to get basic demand curves and supply curves under control. Not as well as it is 50, 60 years later, but he's basically saying, let's systematize Adam Smith and see whether we can set it all up mathematically. And he writes The Mathematics of the Principles, Mathematical Principles of the Theory of Wealth, and discovers that things aren't quite complete. He can't quite completely mathematize Adam Smith. And what bothers him is, where do these demand curves actually come from? And he knows that demand curves are related to income. And he's got income coming from supplying goods and producing goods. And he basically just has producers and consumers, consumers who are also producers. It's a fairly simple model without middle people. Conceptually middle people aren't necessary. But even in a very simple way, he can't get it to work out in a single solution. That somehow he can say, if this is the distribution of wealth in the first place, then he can make the system work. But he says, there could be other distributions of wealth, and the system would still work. And this is critically important. This idea that there can be other distributions of wealth and the mathematics of markets would still work out becomes systematized in the 1880s or so. We can begin to realize that efficiency and the distribution of wealth are different things, or the same thing. They work together. Let me just do it the way I'll do it again and again in this course. Imagine two islands. They're the same size. They have the same quality of soils. They have the same number of people. They have the same number of tools. They have the same level or the same amount of school teachers and school buildings. Okay. Think of all the things that you want to have in an economy. But in one island, it looks like Sweden. And the other island, it looks like Brazil. Both islands can be perfectly efficient. And that's what Cournot discovers. He doesn't really say efficient, but he comes up with the mathematical solutions that are the efficient properties. Okay? But both islands can be efficient. And that's not what you're taught in economics. What you're taught is there's efficiency. And then there's the distribution of wealth. And the distribution of wealth is for politicians to worry about. Economists worry about efficiency. But if you really worry about efficiency, you should be saying both islands can be efficient. We could have an economy where we had a lot more equality and we would still have efficiency. Right. So economists don't say we could redistribute income, we could redistribute land, we could redistribute capital, we could have free schooling, okay, so that schooling is available to all and still have an efficient economy. Okay. that sounds like heresy today, but it's absolutely in economics as the mathematics of economics works out. And so we'll be working with that a lot. But Cournot discovers it, and then it's a process of denial for the next couple hundred years. So I've got two hands up, and let me go back.
What is his definition of itch?
So we'll get into that, but it's basically where the marginal cost of production equals the marginal willingness to pay, that it, you know, somebody's willing to give up the same somebody's, well, then two parties are giving up. The producer's giving up and the producer demander, the buyer is giving up. And those things are equal in value at the margin. Now, what that really means, of course, is what do you mean by real in dollar terms? And if you go back to our two islands, the prices are different in Brazil and in Sweden if they're kept separate. Of course, once we have trade, then they all come together. But as long as those two islands are different, you'll see different prices of rice, different prices of beef, different prices for bicycles, different prices for shoes, just because of the distribution of assets. But it doesn't mean the economies aren't both efficient. They can both be efficient as long as you've got competition on both islands and as long as you don't have too many externalities on both islands, as long as you have, you know, perfectly informed buyers and sellers and all the assumptions of economics. Okay? And all those things can exist, but you have two different economies. Cournot discovers this, and for this he's important. It's not usually talked about today, but just to date it to 1837 is important. Okay. So the third person I want to talk about is another French philosopher, Auguste Comte. And he too is rarely recognized, but he's a great believer in human progress, and he's a great believer in the natural sciences. And among social philosophers, there's a lot of physics envy. The idea that the natural sciences are just way ahead of social understanding. And Comte looks at what's happening in the natural sciences and says the social sciences need to emulate the natural sciences in terms of methods. And Comte writes a lot about methodology in the social sciences. Comte also, however, goes one step further and says, people are just really irrational, but we can bypass a lot of this irrationality. We can put scientists in government. Now you say, well, wait a minute, of course there's scientists in government. But in the 19th century, there weren't that many scientists in government until about the 1880s. Okay. Basically, we had kind of ordinary people running government. Unfortunately, we have pretty ordinary people running government still. But but Comte's idea was that there's really no reason for politicians to be arguing over reality. Okay? Scientists understand reality better than we do. And so let's have scientists in government sort of documenting the way things are. Let's have natural scientists saying this is the way it is. Let's have engineers saying, you know, if you want to build a bridge, here's how you build a bridge. You don't need politicians arguing over how to build a bridge. And furthermore, scientists are really best at explaining how things could be. You know, if we want the world to look different, then there's no reason having politicians arguing over how the world could be. Scientists are better at that. And so let's have scientists do that. And then this means democracy, you only need to describe, to choose what kind of a world, of the worlds that the scientists say we could have, democracy is just about choosing those different directions. Shall we go this way or shall we go that? And this is the beginning of what we call progressive governance. And it's called progressive governance because Comte literally is using this word again and again and again to saying to accelerate progress, we should really organize ourselves to be progressive, to move along, to get our butt in gear and stop doing stupid stuff and use science much more effectively than we have. And so by the 1860s, Germany is setting up forestry departments with silviculturalists in running the German forestry departments. By World War, or by the Civil War, the United States sets up the National Academy of Sciences to help deal with basic ballistics, to make better guns, to learn how to shoot artillery better. The basic reason we have a National Academy of Sciences is to be better at war. We set up the U.S. Geological Survey to survey the land and make better maps and find out where the mineral resources are. By the 1890s, we're setting up a Forest Service. It's not really until 1917 that we set up the Forest Service we have today, but by the 1890s, we're beginning to survey the forest, set land aside in forest lands to begin to manage forests scientifically, because we have this expertise available, and private enterprise won't do it, but we can do it publicly. Okay? And the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, established in the early 1970s, is kind of the last progressive agency set up. We set up the Public Health Service in the 19-teens sometime, mostly going around with World War I and the Spanish flu, though there were public health-like services before that. But the one we have today dates till then. So this idea that you really establish science in government is very recent. And economics is a part of that. Economics gets drawn into government in the 1936 Flood Control Act, where the U.S. Congress says, please, every politician is trying to propose dams be built in their district. So a whole bunch of federal revenues will go to this part of Tennessee or that part of the state of Washington. And we need some rational way to choose between the dams. And economists get drawn into government to pick and choose, to do benefit-cost analysis, to say what is best. And in that process of being asked to say what is best, we violate our basic theory. We forget that there's a Brazil and a Sweden that could be separate islands. We sort of say, well, let's take the income distribution as given. In effect, favor the distribution that exists. But other things happen in the 30s that are also important. But progressive governance, you know, is something that we're so accustomed to today. Yet at the same time, the Tea Party is complaining about white-coated scientists in government telling us what to do. You know, there's a disconnect because there are problems with progressive governance. So I've got a hand up here.
You're saying sort of to match the ecosystem around them, to manage it, they call on economists to make decisions rather than scientists?
Well, because, I mean, basically we're talking about what are the benefits and the costs of building a dam. And so it's what's the value of flood control? What's the value of hydroelectricity? What's the value of transforming dry land into irrigated agricultural land.
But then they don't say what's the value of this land when it's untouched.
That really doesn't begin to show up until the late 1960s, and that's very much the birth of environmental economics. So yes, that comes on, but not for a while. Yeah, not for a while. Excuse me. This is why I brought my coffee, but I didn't drink it while I should have been drinking it.
We've talked a little about science not being welcome or not being... people not really wanting science in government, but what about if you look back to Plato in 300 or 400 BC when he's advocating for that?
Hey, Plato is advocating, yeah, for a scientist king, you know, scientist philosopher king. And, you know, that idea certainly scientists dream all the time about. Francis Bacon, you know, was sort of, yeah, imagining this sort of science having some kind of a God's eye view of the system that we could then manipulate and make work, and that's in our scientist ego all the time. And, yeah, scientists get together and make declarations on behalf of all of us, most of which are good, but not always. But this, you know, sort of this arrogance of science is very much there. And yet we're also desperate for better answers given the mess we've created. Yeah, so all of this, yeah, it's part of us.
Isn't there currently actually the opposite trend within science to say, okay, we can't solve everything with just scientific advice. We need to take into account economics. We need to take into account social systems.
Yes, and so simultaneously the realization that, I mean, there's been a series of realizations, one of which is that people have to buy into science, which maybe isn't the way I'd like to put it myself. I'd like to say truck drivers have a lot of knowledge that's also important. But the scientist perspective is that we need to communicate science better to people, but we also need to be listening to the people in order to get them to listen to us. And so that is true increasingly today, to get the buy-in. But there's also increasingly the sense that we really are in the Anthropocene, that human systems are the drivers of the problems we have, and that we need to understand the whole socio-ecological, you know, socio-economic, technological, ecological, biophysical earth in order to understand the mess we're in. And so scientists, a few scientists, are beginning to talk that way. Yeah. But just where do, you know, where does democracy and, you know, sort of broader understanding fit in? It's a dilemma we're in. On the one hand, we need to make fairly quick decisions, especially about climate change. On the other hand, we have kind of this rebellion of authority, which is perhaps partly legitimate. And, you know, and it's partly an authority that's gotten us into a heck of a mess. Okay. I guess we're ending with a moment of silence, or you guys would like to dream up some more questions. I'm, you know, I'm very comfortable continuing to talk because this stuff from 200 years ago is just incredibly relevant today. And that's why I want to stress it. That's why the history is so important in how we talk about this course and how we think about economics. So I've got another question going.
Okay, so back to Augustine Corneau.
Corneau, yeah.
Yeah, Two Island thing. that was like talked about back in like 1830, whatever.
Yeah. This whole course is about that, okay? And it, you know, we're going to transform that into the problem of climate change and the rights of future generations and how much future generations are entitled to. And the whole problem of sustainability not being a problem of efficiency, but being a problem of distribution between us and our, you know, children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And how do we even think about that? But part of the problem is that economics has blinded us to that question, and the idea of progress has blinded us to thinking about the future, even while today that's the really critical question.
So is the reason why we wouldn't like learn, because I've never heard that before. Yeah. And I've taken that many economics courses, but I don't know, taking basics.
Yeah. It's a basic,
like basic
thing.
Concept. So and stuff just because it's not in...
Because economists were asked to power and went and accepted that call. We were called to power in the 1936 Flood Control Act. We were called to power after World War II with the whole development story. And we accepted that call. But to accept that call, we had to give one answer. Instead of saying, really, we have to work with moral philosophy and politics and talk about the distribution of rights while we're talking about efficiency at the same time. So that's the easy answer. Okay? Yeah.
So it sounds like in order to be accepted generally by the public and by politicians and to have an impact, economists had to sacrifice philosophy for what was perceived as science. And
they went to ideology as opposed to science. But ecologists are sort of in the same situation where they're being called to give answers. But ecology has, you know, 8 or 10 different patterns of thinking. And you get insights from each of those patterns. But ecologists, feeling the desperate situation we're in, have taken up ecosystem services, and it's becoming a dominant way of thinking instead of just one of the ways ecologists think. And then as it becomes dominant, I mean, it has become so dominant that I can't talk ecology in most, you know, in most arenas without using the word ecosystem service, even while the person I'm talking to hates that term as much as I do. But that's just, that has become the way we now talk about ecology, when we should be talking about, if you look at it from an evolutionary ecological perspective, if you look at it from this perspective. And so this is a problem of simplicity rising to the top.
So it's like palatable ideologies versus the complex ones?
It's partly, you know, it's partly correct to call it an ideology, but it's partly a problem of how do 7 billion people talk to each other, except in very simple ways. You know, it gets back to, you know, our television sets speak to us at the 8th grade level because that's the only level we all share together.
I just wanted to point out that I've had the Costanza paper on ecosystem services assigned 3 times in 2 semesters.
Yeah, and Costanza and I have been best of friends and not. I had to wrest the International Society for Ecological Economics out of his hands. And it's a wonderful idea for getting you to think, but it's a terrible idea for actually analyzing problems in a serious way. And so I have a paper called Ecosystem Services from Eye-Opening Metaphor to Complexity Blinder. You know, so the title describes the whole paper. We need metaphors, but if we take them too seriously, they blind us to complexity. And that's the human dilemma, you know, all through. And so that's why, you know, Malthus is so powerful and yet so perplexing and frustrating. That's why Ricardo is so powerful and yet perplexing and frustrating. And we'll actually be using the Ricardo model again in the course for talking about how we understand resource scarcity as economists and get messed up in that model. So, yeah, again, this is, you know, you don't have very good readings. The Google books that you're trying to decipher on the web are hard to read. But this stuff is really, really important. And I'll bring a copy of Cornell and Comte. And I don't have Bentham, but Thursday I'll bring the books so you can say, yes, I've held them in my hands.
They exist.
They exist. Here's where all the trouble, the good stuff and the bad stuff happened. Okay? See you Thursday.